Watch this. No way!
Hello and welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. I am Tom Mills and today I'm joined by Sam Williams.
Hello.
And two special guests from CDP Design. We have Mike Clayton.
Morning from here. I guess it's evening over there. But
good morning, yeah. Mike.
Good morning. And Ed Cartwright. Ed, how you doing?
Yeah, good. Good evening, guys.
Isn't it nice to get Mike back on the pod just before we get going, Tom? It's nice to get him back on. It feels like years ago since we first spoke. And I think it's only something like 8 or 9 months, but like crazy what's gone on in the time since we last spoke. It's just, I guess, kind of nice to get you back on the pod.
Yeah, it'd be good to be on. But it's been a crazy world. I was hoping to be over there last year in the summer, but I guess no one's going anywhere at the moment. Doesn't seem like it anyway.
I don't think you've done many podcasts since our last one either, have you?
Not a few. Well, I mean, what else can you do? Podcasting.
It's a national sport in Australia. I mean, Lucas Michelle does about 5 a day from what I've gathered.
Yeah, I mean, we literally had 3 months where we were allowed out for an hour a day. So I'd go down to the beach and play golf for an hour, and then because the beach is just around the corner, and that was it. We were stuck inside for 3 months.
My favorite memory when we got together that time, Mike, was you joined our platform. We could see you. I didn't think you realized you were on. I think your wife was saying, what are you up to? And you said, doing another podcast. I could just hear in the background her say, not another one. Surely this is getting ridiculous. Anyway, great to have you back on. And Ed, first time on the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. Do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Yeah, I'm Edward Cartwright. I have the difficult task, the pleasant task of being in charge of the London office of CDP, Clayton, DeVries and Pont. Spent some time working with Frank Pont before we all got together. And I help with our business side and a little bit of on-site stuff. At the moment, I'm doing a bit more than usual because Frank's travel is difficult. And our colleagues also in the German office, you know, getting here is not easy for obvious reasons. So slightly spreading myself, including this afternoon where I was back on site. We're just finishing our project down at New Zealand in Surrey, which has been great fun. So that's me.
So in terms of CDP, it's obviously a global brand now. I mean, how did that collaboration come about with you guys then? How did that sort of come about in the first place?
The bottom line is that everybody knew everybody else. So there was already a great friendship and there was a bonhomie. Already Frank had a joint venture with Mike DeVries to do Bloomfield Hills, the cult course out in Detroit. And Mike had pitched when he was part of OCCM with Frank to do a job in England, which didn't get. So there'd been sort of dialogue going on and, you know, I've heard all sorts of stories, not just Frank and Mike DeVries being friends, but I think, didn't you go, you went off to Holland with Billy Longmuir as well and you were playing golf with Frank, weren't you, checking out his courses, Clayton?
Yeah, we were. I stayed with Frank and this was years ago when I was playing the senior tour in Europe. God, that sounds bad. But years ago when I was playing the senior tour in Europe. It was a decade ago now, but Frank and I spent a bunch of time in Holland and we played in Paris together. And so it was, we've known each other for a long time. So kind of the timing was right for me, certainly, and hopefully for the other two guys.
Yeah. And we've been in touch and then various things. I mean, basically the stars just conspired and, or aligned rather, not conspired. And, so we literally were talking and I think the whole thing from start to finish, from should we do this to let's do it to we're going to do it, took about 10 days.
Really?
And it was no more. And, you know, it's been a very pleasant 18 months so far. It's been great. And particularly given the slings and arrows of the pandemic and all the other problems, if you told us that we'd be where we are today, I'm not sure I would have believed it. Maybe Mike knew we were going to be here, but I didn't.
Yeah. Again, and we were talking before you came on, Ed, and obviously looking at the kind of client list that you guys are working with, it's incredible when you think of the variety of the clubs and the parts of the world that you're working. And I suppose I mean, maybe that's kind of great because it's almost like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts in some way, because I know you guys are all sort of either you partner up on certain designs, don't you? Or all three of you will go in or do stuff solo. And I guess that must be quite nice having people in different parts of the world to kind of bounce things off and talk about different projects, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we started having Zooms and Microsoft Teams, actually, to be precise, not Zooms, before the pandemic. So we were in on it before the craze. I can't explain how good it is. I mean, we talk about everything that we're all doing collectively and singularly. What, every 10 days, 14 days, Mike, we sit down?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's great. And who knew in the beginning what it would be like? But it's been a great place to compare, contrast, and also just to do business. I mean, we're in a great position that, you know, I can say this because talk about the three partners for a sec, but, you know, Mike, obviously, with his incredible background and knowledge, Frank, who studied at university at Heriot Watt and did his postgrad in golf course architecture, and then Mike DeVries, who complements it because he's, one might argue, not just designer, but what he does that the rest of us do not do, he can jump on the bulldozer and actually build the thing. And so to have all those skills, so when you're talking about a project, you can see it from the different perspectives. And you know, I'm the rookie. I'm the guy learning just by listening and going a little bit on site. But, you know, for me, I'm being taught by three of the greats, and what a treat. But not just that. It's just the fact that whatever it is, I mean, I'll give you one, for instance, if I may. You know, the Addington, whereas you know we're there. Obviously, all the partners have walked it umpteen times. We need to build a short game area, and that's clear. That's something that's got to happen in the next 12 months. Well, clearly Mike DeVries is the right man to come and you know, but you wouldn't have Mike DeVries just do a short game area normally, but because it's part of our partnership and we can part, and actually we've got some work in Spain that we're going to do, and he's actually wants to help with that. So he'll come to Europe and do those two things at once. And that's fantastic. So it's really about offering the skill set that everybody has to offer. And using people's time and efforts where it can all be complementary, you know, complementary with an E, not an I.
Yeah, no, that's cool, isn't it? And yeah. Obviously, we spent a bit of time down at the Addington, and Mike, you'd be very proud of Tom. He's come a long way in a year. He even staked out a little side flank of the fairway, didn't he? On when we were out doing a little course.
I put one flag down. I feel like I've designed a course.
It was like watching young Alistair McKenzie, yeah, sort of with his. Yeah, a very proud moment.
Yeah, that place should be fantastic. I mean, well, it is fantastic. It's an amazing piece of land. So it's kind of getting it back to the original. Well, in terms of restoring and getting the greens back where and managing the trees, and it'll be an amazing golf course when it's done.
We're going to talk a little bit about the Addington, aren't we? I think shortly, in terms of, because I think that's a particularly interesting model, being a proprietary owned golf course, and you know how that blends into the way you kind of look after the course and develop the site, through the context of kind of looking after golf clubs. And we're gonna have a good chat about that. But before we do, there's a bit of exciting news, isn't there?
Oh, you're starting with that, are you? Okay, well that's fair.
Oh, we've got it. Like, we can't not talk about it.
No.
We?
No,
you're good. This is good drum roll. Good call.
Yeah, drum roll.
So, I don't know, Mike, do you want to tell us a little bit about 7 Mile Beach?
Yeah, well, it's in Hobart, the capital of Tasmania, in the bottom of Tasmania. And I was playing golf with Matt Goggin just after he turned pro. So that's how long ago it was. Matt was, he's the best, one of the better trivia questions in golf, is who was playing with Tom Watson the last day at Turnberry. And when he... Yeah, Matt Goggin was playing. In fact, Matt was tied for the lead on the 15th tee in that Open. So he was a hell of a player. But we were playing a tournament in Sydney, and I just started in the design business, maybe. I've been going a couple of years. That's how long ago it was. And he said, there's a bit of land in Hobart. It's incredible. He said, I'm going to build a golf course on it one day. So I went down there with Matt maybe 10 years ago, maybe 9 or 10 years ago. It's a spit of land about 10 minutes from Hobart Airport. So it's hard to imagine having an interesting golf course near an airport, because by definition, the land's pretty flat. So, but 10 minutes from Hobart Airport on a spit of land is sand dunes in a pine forest. Really? So it's kind of Pine Valley-ish on the water, really. It's an amazing sight. So finally, it looks like we've got there. You know, we're going to planning on starting later this year, and it's a phenomenal sight. It's certainly as good as Bamboogle, which I saw. You know, I first walked that site when it was just marram grass and wallabies who'd never seen a human being, and you know, it was that was a pretty good site, but this one's easily as good. It's incredible, really.
So you've got the agreement ready to go in and start a golf course here on 7 Mile Beach, which is obviously tremendously exciting. So what happens now? What goes on in the planning phase? Do the three of you get together and start rooting? How does this whole thing work?
Well, Mike came down in, Mike DeVries was here in February last year. So we went down there with Matt, and we've already come up with the routing, which is, it's tricky because the land's so good. There are literally hundreds of ways you could route a golf course over it. You know, it's a big site, and everywhere you look, there's a great hole. No matter which direction you look at, there's an amazing hole. So, you know, I think we've come up with a pretty good routing, really, at the moment. It looks compact. It gets to and from the water three times in the round. So, you know, it's not just sort of half the holes on the water and half of them away from the water. So it works the land really well. But it's, you know, it's perfect land for golf, the best site I've ever seen. So the routing's a year old now, really. So it's really a matter of Mike getting on a plane and jumping on the bulldozer and building it. Well, and before that, getting rid of the trees. It was an old pine plantation, and pine trees are really weeds down here. So it's not any sort of environmental.
Not putting any pressure on it.
Well,
you know, you
that specific type of pine tree that was, you know, they planted them for wood chips. They're just rubbish trees. So it's a matter of getting rid of those, clearing the site, and not messing it up.
How does it feel going into this as a new build, Mike, given the, obviously, you know, Bamboogle was such a massive success, wasn't it, for you? And, it's just, you know, revered around the world. How does it feel going into this as a new build? Do you feel like there's a lot of things that you kind of take into that? Or do you feel maybe is experience kind of just like polish the art somewhat? I mean, is it kind of just feel very much the same as when you went to Bamboogle?
Yeah, a little. Yeah, it's, we did Bamboogle with Tom Doak, and Tom did an amazing job there. It's an incredible course. But, you know, again, it's the, you know, can you swear on this thing?
Of course, you
always. Can. Always encouraged, okay. Actually, Mike. Yeah.
Okay. So the only brief at Bamboogle with Richard Sattler was don't fuck it up. So. Yeah, it was, and it's really the same down here with Matt. Yeah, I mean, Richard didn't play golf. Richard knew nothing about golf. So the complete opposite of Matt, really. But, you know, it's a matter of, there were no plans at Bamboogle. There was not, I think there was a one-page routing map, but that was it. There were no irrigation plans there was an irrigation plan, but there was certainly no drawings of greens or holes or, you know, we weren't flying on the seat of our pants, but, you know, it was certainly a course created as it came out of the ground. And when you saw things that would work or didn't work, then you could tweak it and change it. So it's going to be the same thing here, really. We've got a routing map and we know where the holes are, and Mike will come down and we'll build them. We'll shape the greens and figure out where the bunkers go and follow the routing map we've got, really, which is, you know, it sounds simple, but it's, you know, it's really a matter of not screwing it up. One, and two, making the best golf you can out of it. And I think, you know, it's such good land that, you know, in some ways they're the hardest jobs because, you know, you're potentially building a course that's one of the best in the country.
Mm. From what I've heard, you almost can't fuck it up, to use the brief at Bamboogle. It's almost so good that it's just like, you know, even a bad job here would be a great golf course, right?
Well, maybe, but you know, well, I think you can screw it up because I think you can not get the most out of it. If you've got a little land as good as this and you build a golf course that's only 7 out of 10 or 8 out of 10, then you've screwed it up. And this course needs to be, I don't think anyone will build a course better than Royal Melbourne in Australia, but it needs to be on that level, really. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be, because, you know, the site's that good. So if it's not in that class, then you have screwed it up.
We were just trying to build you up for a massive sort of like, ta-da, when it's done. Yeah. Can I just ask a quick one as well? Where's Seven Mile Beach come from?
So Seven Mile Beach is the name of the beach. In fact, the town around the corner from the golf club is called Seven Mile Beach. So on the spit of land, the one side of it's Seven Mile Beach, the other side's Five Mile Beach.
Got you.
So it's... yeah, it's been called Seven Mile Beach forever. In fact, there was a great story about Bumboogle, which is one of the great and most recognisable names in golf, certainly for a new course. Everyone's who's heard of golf's heard of Bumboogle. Mike Kaiser, who was the developer of Bandon Dunes, genius developer, you know, built some amazing golf courses, wanted to call it Tasmania Dunes. And Bumboogle was the name of Richard, of the farm that Richard Sattler runs. It had been called Bumboogle since 1860 or something. And Richard, you know, that was the one thing Richard was definite about. He said, I'm not going to change the name. It's a perfect name. And of course, it's, I mean, you couldn't have come up with a better name. If you tried to dream up a name better than it, you couldn't have managed it. So, you know, it's such a recognizable name. So I think I think Matt's plan is just to go with Seven Mile Beach.
And you've got this fantastic piece of land, Mike, and you're looking at it when you were planning the routing a year ago, as you say. Are you... As a designer, are there rules that you follow when you look at sort of how you're going to make this golf course? Are you, you know, I am going to make this a par 72. It's going to have this many par fives, threes. Or is it just you let the land dictate to you what it's going to be?
It's an interesting question. Both, really. Yeah, I mean, it happens to be par 72 with four par fives and four par threes, but the best course in the world's got two par fives and two par threes. So there are no rules. That's the old course. So there are no rules in terms of course design. Merion's got two par fives, the second and the fourth. That's it. And there are so many great courses that are par 70 or 69 or what's Swinley Forest, 68 or 69. I can never work out what their par is because they changed that 15th hole, but there are way too many examples of great courses that break the rules to think that you need to follow a prescribed set of, you know, a formula for what a golf course should be.
Mm.
So the fact that it happens to be a par 72 with four par fives and four par threes is, that was really the way it turned out. We didn't, you know, when we went back to the house after walking the site for a few days, we figured out, you know, we started writing it down and, wow, that was what it was. But that was how the land worked, really. And, of course, it's easy to say that. When it comes to building it, there might be a hole that's out there that we've got as a par four that looks better if we stretch once the trees are gone, it might look better if we stretch it out and make it a par five. And there might be a par five on the map that once you clear the trees, there might be an amazing green site 50 yards short of where the green's drawn, so you make it a par four. So
I suppose that's the beauty of having fluid plans and nothing written down on paper, that you can just be a lot more fluid with it as it grows. You can change it as it goes along, I suppose.
Yeah, the routing map is really a guide to what we're going to do, and you know, I'm sure it'll change. Not the basic flow, the way the course flows and the way the holes follow each other, that won't change, but what the holes look like, we don't really know because it's covered in trees. So once we clear the trees, I'm sure we'll see different things and tweak it, which is part of the fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to get there with a bulldozer and see what it's all about. When are you planning on breaking ground, and roughly how long do you think the build is going to take?
Well, partly it depends when Mike can get here. You know, it's Australia's a hard place to get into at the moment. In fact, there are, I think, 37,000 Australians who want to get home who can't, because the quarantine is, you know, there aren't enough quarantine rooms in hotels. So it's crazy trying to get in here. But it will help when Mike gets a vaccine. And, you know, I'm thinking he'll be here by certainly the second half of this year is the plan.
And what sort of rough timescale do you think we're looking at in terms of the first tee shot?
Well, probably a year and a half, I would think. Yeah, it would, I mean, it ought to be a quick build. So I think Mike will be here for probably 9 months, maybe. And then, you've grown the grass on it, waiting for the grass to grow. So I would think a year and a half before we play on it.
It's probably worth pointing out Mike's going to do what he did with Kate Wickham. Literally, he is transposing himself down there, isn't he?
Yeah, so Mike and his wife, they did that when they built Kate Wickham, which is an amazing course on King Island, which is a rock in the middle of Bass Strait, which is the land between the mainland and Tasmania. So he went to King Island and built Kate Wickham, I guess.
Is that Darius Oliver? He was involved with that as well.
Yeah, that was about 3 years ago, I think they did that. So Mike came down and bought his kids as well. So they were going to school on King Island, which is a tiny island with, I think there are 1,500 people live there.
Wow.
So it's an amazing, in terms of where you guys are, it's unbelievably remote.
Yeah.
And even for us, it's tricky to get to. There's one flight goes in there a day. That's not a little charter thing from the small airport near Kingston Heath. There's one flight from the main airport a day. So it's, which has maybe 25 people on it. So it's a,
sounds like such a good project, to be fair, doesn't it? And I think, you know, from what we've read and kind of discussed and stuff with Ed and everything like that, it sounds like a pretty exciting project.
Well, and
18 months to build a golf course. I mean, like, wow, as well. Like, hopefully, quick. Maybe we might even clip a few balls down there one day in the not-too-distant future.
Well, you know, the thing
future.
About Tasmania was they had the two established clubs in Hobart. They're kind of okay golf courses. They're probably, I think, the best ones, maybe ranked 80th in Australia. And then Bumboogle was built, and then Cape Wickham, and then Seven Mile Beach. Tasmania's ought to have, depending on how many courses Matt does, because there's room for four courses at Seven Mile Beach. Tasmania ought to have five of the best 10 courses in the country now, really. I mean, it's already got three of the best 10. So, if you had Seven Mile Beach on it, it's gone from a place that had no golf tourism at all to being the hotbed of golf tourism in Australia, really.
Yeah, I mean, you start putting four courses, I guess, on site, you're in that sort of abandoned dunes type territory, aren't you? Of having, it becomes a resort in its own, kind
four's
of merit,
probably
right?
Too many for our population, but two I think would be great. And it's a 2.5 hour drive from Seven Mile Beach to Bumboogle. So we play four courses, three or four courses, hopefully in the world top hundreds. A pretty amazing trip, really. So fantastic for tourism down there.
So I guess kind of wishing you all the success with that. One of the things we were going to want to kind of dive into a bit today, I guess, a bit of an interesting topic, because obviously you guys spend a lot of your time restoring golf courses all over the world, architects of different heritage, often bringing them back to, whether it's bringing back a specific style or strategic principles of the architect. And I guess through that, we kind of talked on it. I think last time you came on the pod, Mike, we talked about, the nature of golf clubs and how they're run and, rotating committees and everything like that. And saw you wrote a blog article not that long ago and thought, well, that'd be quite interesting to talk about. So kind of looking at some of the restoration stuff within the UK and I guess kind of through that, the dreaded committees that seem to kind of, they're an evil but a necessary evil, aren't they? I think to a certain respect. And, Mike, you kind of summed it up as, I think, custodians of the course.
And we, all of that sort of work we did in Australia, and we worked at, most of the clubs in Australia, we always dealt with committees who were terrific to deal with. Because if you made a logical case and a sensible case as to why you wanted to change a golf course or change a hole, or they, in almost every instance, took the advice and went with what you were saying, because you could make a good case for it. In fact, the irony was that it's almost as though the poorer the golf course, the more the argument about changing it. It was bizarre. I mean, we worked at Victoria, which is a home club of Peter Thompson and Jeff Ogilvie, and a tremendous course in Australia. It's in the, I think it's kind of ranked 10th in Australia, which is really good now. And, we almost never had an argument about anything there, because they had an amazing photo of the golf course in 1930. And really it was, let's just put this back. And once they'd settled on that principle of let's put this back, then it stopped all the arguments about, well, I don't want to build that bunker, or that can't cut that tree down, or all those little kind of specific arguments about single things that weren't really important on the scale of the big plan went away once that accepted the principle of let's put this back. And so if there was ever a discussion, get the photo out. The bunker used to be here. Let's put it back. There weren't any trees there. There weren't supposed to be trees there. Let's cut them down. And that evolved really well, that plan. And really in Australia, all of this work started. Jack Nicklaus came down in 1976, after they played the Australian Open at the Australian, which was a fantastic old windswept course in Sydney. And he built something indistinguishable from anything in Florida, really, in fairness. So, it's called the Australian, but it should be called the American. And everyone thought at that point, anything Jack Nicklaus did was amazing and anything American was amazing. And I think it took 4 or 5 years for people to kind of come down on the side of, well, actually, it's not that great. And rather than blowing up these places and changing them, we should look at restoring them and putting them back the way they were, because all the best courses in Australia had changed a lot from when they were built. And there was a really good superintendent at Kingston Heath, Graham Grant, who he started it. He just went to Kingston Heath. He got the job there. He chopped a whole bunch of trees down and he put back a whole lot of bunkers that had been overgrown or filled in, and really got that course a long way down the road to being as good as it was in 1930. And when we started at Victoria, we really just, I remember going to the first meeting in Victoria and I said, the club that's done this the best is Kingston Heath. They've done an amazing job with that golf course and that's why it's rated so highly. And the one guy on the committee said, so I think they've ruined that course, which was an opinion that that was 1995. So 25 years later, you won't get anyone to even utter the word that they ruined that course, because, it was barely in the top 100 before they started. Now it's, it's a fixture in the top 25 or 35 courses in the world. It's the second best club course in Australia. It's amazing. But if Kingston Heath in 1980 had been left alone, it would barely be in the top 20 now in Australia. But it was the place that started it.
Yeah. Ed, is it something you find when you are dealing with CDP that you go to clubs and you get a little bit of resistance from, say, Greens committees, just a kind of resistance to change more than... It's not necessarily they think they know better. It's more of a resistance to change. Do you find that?
Well, that's difficult to answer in a way, because by the time we get asked to go in, they've kind of made a decision that they need some help or they need some advice. And, by definition, the committee / the grandees of the place have already come to the conclusion the course by definition isn't right. Otherwise, why would they ask us in? That said, it's strange because if I think about some of our existing mandates where we're working, sometimes you get a little resistance and you say, clearly X has to happen. And you find that X, they don't want it to happen because X was done by one of the recent chairman of Green or members. And it's the custodians of the course piece that Mike wrote in December, if anybody has read it, and if anybody hasn't read it, they should. It talks about why would you want to be on a green committee? And if you are on a green committee, are you qualified to be on it? It asks the right pertinent questions. And one of the big issues in this country, which is very different from other parts of Europe. I mean, I now, working with Frank, I say this as somebody, Frank's obviously very active and has been for quite some time in continental Europe. We have a governance system in the UK where on average, your Green Committee member, including the chairman even, doesn't last more than 3 or 4 years. And sometimes at one of the courses where I went for a meeting a couple of weeks ago, unbelievably, it's 2 years is the rotational system. How on earth is that supposed to work? I mean, I think, Mike, you used the story, you get 1 year to sort of learn what you should be doing. The second year you might do it. The third year you become old news. So this doesn't work.
Which is the point Mackenzie made in the book. In the spirit of St. Andrews, Mackenzie wrote about this 100 years ago. It's a terrible system. Don't do it.
Yeah.
And we have, read the book. He explains why that system is never going to be a good one.
Well, you did in your notes. I think at the end of your piece, you said that every club should give its Green Committee and its Christmas stocking, and maybe they can do it as a New Year's present now, a copy of Spirit at St Andrews, and everybody should read it, along with one or two other journals. I totally agree. So, yes, it's a strange situation because you're meeting with people and you know that frequently, by the let's say you get appointed and you're doing a long-term plan. I mean, look at the Addington. The Addington, forget COVID because it's delayed us a bit, but even if COVID hadn't happened, the Addington is a five-year project, de minimis. There's so much work to do there. The infrastructure's got to be sorted out. The woodland's got to be sorted out. And that's before you even get to the architecture and the stuff that we do. So it's a big project and it's a great project. But, you know, I think about how it normally goes. In a normal club, and the Addington, we're very lucky because it's run by a managing director, it's owned by a trust, and there's a very stable management structure at the top.
So rare. Yeah,
that's very so out rare. Of the ordinary in this country. Now, even if it had just been 5 or 6 years, but to make a real difference, you know, Frank's been the architect at Dupin and Royal Hague, which are now in the top five in Europe, and he's taken them from not nothing, but they were way down to that. He's been at it for 15 years, and the rankings really kicked in after, say, 11, 12. You know, Frank and I are both ex-bankers, and there's one of these charts that ex-bankers do, which is a regression chart of how long you've worked there and the ranking. And surprise, surprise, the correlation is damn good. So, you know, you're dealing with people, and you know in England or in the UK, they'll be gone. It changes, the whole thing changes. Whereas in the rest of Europe, I mean, my favourite story, which I've told before, is at Dupin in Utrecht, if you want to join the Green Committee, or if you get asked to join the Green Committee, you must sign a document to say that you adhere to the plan.
Really?
So there's a continuity that comes through that. And I think the cycle's longer as well, which helps. And it's very interesting because in the UK, obviously, it's different, but it's changing. It's just beginning to change. We've recently taken on two new assignments, CDP. I'm not going to mention the clubs because that would be unfair. But what I would say is that one of those clubs has gone to the Dupin system. It's the first club in England I've ever heard of doing this. So starting, I think, in fact, I think it's right now, this month, starting this month, you come onto the Green Committee and you will sign a document to say that you adhere to the plan. And the other club I'm thinking of, in order to make sure there was continuity at the top, they have created a subcommittee, which is a course restoration committee. And those people will be drawn from different parts of the club. And they will be, they're spending a lot of time with us and other people in the profession to have real education, and they will see it through. So they will be the same people that we're dealing with now will be the people we'll see, hopefully, I think so, that's how it's planned, at the end of this. So this is a very different governance situation from what we see in 90% plus of the clubs in that we deal with here in this country. And I hope, yeah, but I hope it continues because, you know, Mike said in that article, again, I'm not here just to be a Mike Clayton spokesperson, but, you know, the fact is that...
We're all Mike Clayton spokespeople.
Yeah, there you go. So, no, but the thing
just
is...
Just try and reword it.
These people, you know, we all love our clubs. We all love our courses, okay? I think that goes for 99.9% of club members. That's not what's at stake here. It's about being able to imbue yourself in the information, looking outside the gates of your club as well. That's another thing. The xenophobia that goes on in this country, people just look and they play the same place. And I think, you know, Mike's article talks about the experience that you'd get from playing your place as your own personal experience. You've got to broaden your horizons if you're going to be in this committee. You've got to see what other people are doing and what's going on. And you can't do that on a 2 or 3 year rotational system because by the time you've downloaded the information that you could do it, guess what? You're not on the committee anymore, which is not very useful. So I think there's got to be a change. I think it's beginning to happen. And I do think that... a lot of clubs are being very introspective at the moment with regard to their governance. And, you know, we believe that for order for us to deliver the best work, working with the most stoic governance, well, that's bad English, I'm sorry, but you know what I mean, is very important.
Yeah, and I mean, And it's interesting to hear about those clubs because they're kind of out of the ordinary. But I mean, when you think about the golfing landscape in the UK, there's just so much, like, it's crazy how much history there is in golden age courses, whether irrespective of rankings, they're kind of all spectrums. They're all over the place. And then you think, you know, a lot have probably throughout the years probably gone, I'd guess to say, almost beyond recovery to a certain extent, where, you know, they've been modified such by the have a go hero greens committee that sort of, you know, let's try this and then we try the next idea. And, you know, I think the thing you talk about in your article, Mike, is, you know, these people are lawyers, they're doctors, they're accountants, they're people who appreciate the need for qualifications in what they do. And then they end up on a greens committee. And then because their opinions are already always trusted, they just seem to have a complete brain fade when it comes to it. In terms of, I think playing ability is a pretty interesting one, because I look at, you know, obviously going and visiting a lot of clubs and seeing lots of different committees and speaking to lots of different people, you get a sense that clubs generally put the better golfer onto their greens committee. And I think that naturally has an impact perhaps over some of the decisions that you see that happen there. Is there a case to say that, you know, greens committees maybe should almost kind of be representative of, you know, different playing abilities, you know, women and men, or is it, you know, do you think that's kind of maybe a bit of a duff point?
Yeah, I think it's really dangerous to listen to the opinions of good players, because it's almost sometimes, well, but almost by definition, a lot of them are young. Yeah, well, lots of them are young and don't have any idea. And they look at the game around the way they play it. That's all they look at. So the perfect green committee should be a permanent committee. I mean, every club ought to have a permanent board or committee of the three or five or eight, seven people, or whatever number you pick, who know the most and understand the golf course and understand golf course architecture and design and what makes good golf courses. So at Metropolitan, my club, which is a terrific course in Melbourne, there are five or six people that should be on. I mean, it's a 13 or 14 person green committee, which is a crazy number anyway. But there are four or five people in the club, Lucas Michel being one of them, who's a young guy, who's a, you know, the US Met amateur champion, who's got a great sense of, or head for golf course architecture at 26. He should be on it, and he should be on it forever. And you pick five or six people who understand the golf course, who understand architecture, who know where the course needs to go, and they're it. They're the ones who make the decision, and it doesn't change. But rolling it over is just, you know, you're always going to get people who are good and people who are less good.
Yeah, but Mike, let me tell you, and I can say this with a lot of experience, I can, you know, clubs I'm a member of, one of which I know the statistic actually, which is that 56% of people who go onto these committees go on to high office, to captain, to captain, and etc. They're stepping stones to the top of the tree. With regard to the Green Committee, you know, they're not there for the reasons that you advocate in the article, and that's the problem. That the governance is, you need to divorce the Green Committee from, you know, if people want to go onto the House Committee and count the number of currants in the current bun, I'm being a bit rude, but you know, that's fine. That's one thing. But I do think that the sorry, that was out of place. But I do think that the Green Committee is different. It needs to be taken out of the general club governance, if possible. But of course, that's not easy in the current structure that many places have in this country.
And it's exactly the same here. And in fact, I get the sense that courses over there do a better job of looking after their architectural heritage than we did here for the longest time. And committees were terrible at, did an awful job of tree planting in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So 50 years, 60, 70 years later, we're all dealing with the problems of mistakes that were made a long time ago. But I get the sense, I mean, perhaps it's because I spend a lot of time, you know, looking around the best courses on the Heathlands when I'm in London, that, you know, that they're pretty well preserved. But perhaps I'm wrong there, but, you know, I think you guys did a better job of maintaining what you had than we did in Australia.
Yeah, the other problem, of course, is if you go down that route of saying, you know, these five guys are going to represent the golf club and the direction that the golf club and the course should go in, is if those people's opinions change over time, that becomes a bit of a pickle. And if you pick the wrong person who maybe don't align, then you're in a real state, aren't you?
That's so. Always the one. Whenever we have this conversation, that's the counterpoint. That's always the counterpoint. You know, guess what, get the wrong person, and you know, the why not, if you have person who made all the mistakes 30 years ago, you have their equivalent doing it now, where you're no better off. But I think around this has to be the structure of a well-researched, well thought through plan that nods to the past in the case of a restoration, understands, look, you can go and build new golf courses tomorrow if you've got the money and the land. You can't get Mr. Colt to come back and build another one, or Mr. Fowler or Mr. Simpson. Sadly, they're indisposed at the moment. So, you know, you can't go. And today at New Zealand, I'm down there and we're putting back very simple, very Simpson stuff that was filled in after the war. I think actually as much through budget as ignorance there. That was just, you know, they filled in bunkers like a lot of people did in the war. But putting it back is just wonderful to behold. It's also because we're very lucky that the whole country was well photographed by the RAF in 1945. It's very simple to see these things in many cases. And so why would you not cherish these things? I mean, you know, Mike, you always talk about Simpson and the fact that he always designed such that the middle of the fairway was not the ideal line invariably. And you always go mad about the courses around Paris that he built. I think those are your, and you know, why would we not cherish that? Just because you've got a modern golf ball that goes a bit further, but the dynamics of which side to be of the fairway and the green complex are just as beautiful and relevant as they were then, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, Simpson was amazing. I mean, the stuff he did in Paris was incredible. And I keep telling Australian friends of mine, the best trip you can do in the world is, well, one of them is Paris through Belgium into Holland, and you can play a dozen fantastic golf courses in terms of Australian terms, it's a short drive.
Yeah. Well, incredible. I mean, our regular listeners will know that I'm itching to go and play golf in Holland. Golf out there is meant to be superb. And obviously people we know and speak to say, you know, Belgium and also kind of stuff around north of France, just absolutely spectacular, isn't it?
Yeah, there's amazing golf over there. It's incredible. Which is why it's kind of, and I played a bunch of French Opens at Chanty. Then we moved to Paris National, that Ryder Cup course. And it was such a disappointment to leave what was probably the best course we played on tour to go to that new course, which was just a kind of faux American type. I'm not sure how you would describe that course, but I mean, it was in decent shape and it was difficult and it was a good venue, but it wasn't Chanty.
I mean, but just playing devil's advocate here, I suppose, you know, you guys are lucky to be working with really good golf clubs, because courses that are appointing architects and doing restoration work, they've got budget to spend on them. So, you know, and invariably, you know, high ranking clubs have more success, have more financial means sometimes, but not always. But for guys who maybe aren't appointing restoration experts to come in and, you know, strip the course back to what it was originally, you've kind of got to sympathize, because you know, the people that are going on to greens committees now are watching courses like Golf National and Ryder Cup, and they're looking at these things. And that's now starting to look like, you know, to them, possibly, this is the stuff that golf looks like. They turn the golf on at the weekend and they get the, you know, they get the cycle of the PGA Tour, which just all looks the same. You know, you know what, who wants to go and play some of those courses? And it's not about bashing those, but, you know, though the Golf National works well for that particular style of golf course, if that's what you want to build. But if you're on the greens committee at, you know, a cult course with, you know, fantastic history and, you know, great topography and all that sort of stuff, and you start trying to splash a load of water into it, it's just not going to work, is it? So you've kind of, I guess, without trying to shove it down people's throats, you almost want people to just be curious if that stuff they're going into, right? And trying to take an interest in just the breadth of stuff that's out there.
Yeah. That's part of a research process, is to actually look at the bones of the place, look at the history and see, and then define it. You know, the course reports we write, we define what the architectural principles were that Colt or Fowler or Simpson, whoever it was, put into place, because that is going to determine an awful lot of the decision-making that goes on. I don't think it's just restorations. I have to say, the only thing I disagree with you, Sam, is you know, we've just picked up a new client in actually near you at Enfield.
Yeah.
You know, in Starbridge. And there, that's
golf courses there.
Sorry?
Two good golf courses. Yeah.
Yeah. And two different golf courses, one stuck in an old plantation and one obviously on Heathland. And I'm being a bit general, but you get that, roughly speaking, that's correct. And that's not a restoration project. That is a renovation project. You know, the job there is to bring in not just Frank, but also, I mean, Mike's walked the course, thankfully, before he got here before COVID. You know, the idea is to improve upon it, and it's not to be at all slavish to the past. That the club has made it very clear what they want to do. They want to improve our courses. We want to make them better. And so in that case, it's less about the design principles and such like, because clearly they're not so relevant. It's more about what you're going to do and what the framework is of that. And then once you've set the framework, is then to do the hole by hole analysis.
Yeah. 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 And the great myth of American golf, for people who haven't been there, is that people watch the PGA Tour from America, certainly in Australia, and they think that's what American golf is, where that's not what American golf is at all. Nothing like what true American golf is. Well, which is a broad generalization, but you're not going to see the Tour playing at Sandhills or National Golf Links of America or Cypress Point or the Valley Club or Rustic Canyon or, you know, Belvedere or, you know, any number of 200 Crystal Downs. I mean, all those amazing golf courses, the Tour is just not going to go there. So, but people think that what they see on their TV every week from the PGA Tour is what American golf is, when it's not that at all.
No, exactly. But you just see what you see, the event, you know, that's on there because it can host the stadia and it can boast 7,500 yards. We're just going off tangent. The other week they held the PGA event at Wailea, Hawaii, yeah, which I think is a Seth Rayner design. I don't know, Mike, if you caught any of this or Ed, you know, I couldn't help but notice there was an excessive level of mention by the broadcasters around template golf holes. You guys can maybe explain this to me. Obviously, we understand what a template golf hole is, but they seem to be a currency that's only really discussed in America. Like, obviously, there's that whole CB McDonald, Seth Rayner thing, but it seems to be like the new trend where the word Redan seems to keep creeping into the vocabulary every single time. I never heard them refer to the 17th hole once. It was always the Redan. And then there's the Eden hole. And you think American golf fans don't know what they're on about, surely, or maybe they do. I don't know. I just... an observation, penny for your thoughts.
Yeah, it's a flavor of the month thing, I guess. But I mean, did they ever once mention the 15th at North Berwick? And you know, this hole is based on the
I mean, it looked very different on camera. It didn't quite look North Berwick-esque, and I think the nature of the soft grounds and stuff, I dare say it doesn't play quite the same as the 15th. But interesting. I it does seem to be flavor of the month at the moment with a lot of these template holes and stuff.
I actually think this is part of what's going on. There was an interview, actually, I say it's an interview, it might have been one of our partners' meetings, Mike. I can't remember because we have our little chats. But remember, you said to me when we first started CDP at one point, somebody said, you know, why are there suddenly this interest in renovation and restoration? And you said, it was because it took this long to get to the point that they all built, you know, just before the war. It took this long to get to the point where they were such a state that you had to do something about them.
Yeah.
And that's a good way of looking at it. You know, I think that maybe just Anno Domini is the reason that there's all this interest in architecture and doing something with these courses around the world. Maybe it's just because, you know, you've had so many iterations, those that have been trying to do things to the courses, you've had the failed attempts or the injudicious attempts. Now it's like, let's do it right. Yeah. And the trees always got to be dealt with. It's been how many, you know, trees double in their mass every 22 years because they grow at 3% a year, right? So do the math, you know, add it up from the war. That's an awful lot more, you know, for instance, and obviously that's a Mike's favorite subject as well. So these things take time. Anno Domini has to happen. Time has to pass in order for them to become so important that you've got to get them right. And I just wonder if the whole thing's conspired such that, you know, the last 10 years and the next one or two decades is going to be about sorting out architecture.
Which is why committees are so important. Someone makes a decision around a committee table that takes, might take 10 minutes, might take half an hour, but either way, it takes less than 24 hours to make the decision. So that's implemented, whether a green's built or trees are planted or whatever, new trees, whatever it is. And it, in the case of trees, it takes them 50 years to do their worst or their best. And then it's another decision and a fight, and you cut them down and you're back where you started from. So, so one 20-minute decision has half-century ramifications or century-old ramifications. Tom Doak just restored Yarra Yarra, which is a great Alex Russell course in Melbourne. Russell was Mackenzie's partner in Australia. And it took that club, 60 years to wreck the golf course that Alex Russell had left them. I watched one after another terrible decisions made by that committee. And Tom came in and fixed it in 2 years.
Mm.
But it was amazing.
It almost has to get to the point where you want going on a diet or weight loss, so you have a point of realization when all of a sudden you can't get a certain pair of jeans on, maybe.
That's exactly right.
Analogy.
But it slowly got to the point where if Alec Russell had come back, he would have gone crazy at the things they'd done to the golf course. I mean, I walked around with Gil Hance. Gil walked three holes and said, "This is just a really bad Southern Californian golf course. Why does anyone think this place is any good?" And I played there last week, and it's amazing how much better it is. But really? Wow, it was a tree massacre. I mean, he chopped down more trees than I ever would have cut down. And they went, he restored all the greens that wrecked, and it's back being one of the best courses in Melbourne. But it was, that was a classic example of, committees making decisions around a table that had ramifications for 50 or 60 years.
The other thing about the snap decisions, Mike, you have to bear in mind, and I often say this to clients when we start talking to them, they say, what's the process? How are we going to do this? How are we going to go from here to having the course we want? And, we always start off by saying you've got to research it well, you've got to get the right plan in place, we need to do a lot of preparatory work. And I say that when the spade goes in the ground, whatever you decide to do, you're stuck with it for at least a generation because there's pride. I'm talking about when green committees just make decisions, let's go and move that bunker, whatever. And then they go, actually, boys, it's not really worked out well. I know, but Joe Bloggs did it and he's still a member and we can't really, we'll have to just leave it for now.
Captain next year now, isn't he? He's captain. We can't possibly move that. Yeah. Well, now he's bloody president. There's no way we're going to have to build another three bunkers around it. We'll have to give it a name. We'll have to give the hole a name with his bunker on it. He's just like, digging a grave yourself, aren't you, I think.
And that's the problem. So Mike's right about the buildup of things there, but there's also, this goes back to governance, and the whole thing's a big circle because it goes back to governance again. You make these decisions without the plans and thoughts and the people are there as smiling at you in the bar. What the heck are you going to do? But if you haven't got the right process in place, you're probably going to just say, okay, we'll let it go. And if you have those compromises all over the golf course, I'll give you a clue. It's not what it should be.
Well, one of the interesting projects that you guys have taken up, of course, is the Addington, which I'm keen to have a chat about for a number of reasons. So first of all is that it's a club that hasn't really gone through a Greens Committee renaissance because they basically never had one. And it's just been absolutely untouched, hasn't it? Mike, have you had a chance to walk around the Addington? What's your thoughts on it?
I love it. I played it with Billy Longmill years ago, back in the old days when I was playing the senior tour. and then when I was over in November last year, I walked it for, 2 or 3 days. But so it's a ways from where it should be because, for one thing, the greens have shrunk so far. The trees have encroached on the playing lines. It wasn't in great condition, which is kind of the much less relevant than the first two things. So, it's where Kingston Heath was in 1980, really. But it's probably a better golf course. Certainly as good as Kingston Heath.
I mean, the topography of the place is absolutely fantastic. And what's quite rare, Ed, is that you've actually got some fairly old images, older than you would expect of that golf course, haven't you, which have enabled you to really get a sense of what it used to be.
Well, I'm going to give away one of my trade secrets, which isn't really a great secret, but it's what I think every architect should do when they started a great club like that.
Photoshopped. Photoshopped the old images.
No.
And he knew it.
Behave, Samuel. No. First thing I do once we get commissioned and we get started is I write to all the members and I just introduce us and say, guys, you, this is your place, this is your home. And I reach out to all the members who actually care about the heritage and the amateur archivists that there are in the membership, because there always are some, and always try and engage with them first up. Actually, at Enville, literally this evening, just before we started this podcast, it turns out a member there is a professional photographer, and he's been a member since 1969. He's kept records. I mean, just incredible, right? Quite obviously, you ask these people because they're very helpful and they want to help you, and it helps everybody. So I did that at the Addington, and we always do that. And I also spoke to a couple of historians who we work with a lot, particularly a man called Philip Truitt, who's down at Walton Heath, who knows a lot about Fowler, Abercrombie, Simpson and Croom. He's very, very knowledgeable, which, of course, was their headquarters back in the 20s. That's where that was the headquarters of the business. Anyway, through his introductions, through another intermediary person, we were finished up talking to the son of the second ever pro there. And he had bought at auction in the 1970s some photographs. And he very kindly said, well, you ought to see these. And lo and behold, it was Messrs. Colton Abercrombie building it. It was in the middle of the build at the end of 1913, beginning of 1914. The bunkers weren't even in. It was just the landforms were there. And they dragged everything out and the trees were finished. They were going to be. They hadn't put the bunkers quite in. So there, suddenly, for about six or seven holes, we know exactly what they were like about 6 months before the course opened. Well, that's just unbelievable. Mm. And through that, and then also some great RAF pictures we got hold of, we could see it from top and sideways a lot. So we got to understand a lot that way. And the history of the Addington is, you talk about governance. I mean, it's a hysterical story because it was owned by the Fabes family. And Mrs. Fabes, who I used to play at the Addington back in the 1980s, not quite as old as Clates, but I'm getting there. And there's a great story. By the time the family looked after it, but they didn't really, you know, they just looked after it. And they thought, and her great line was, God will look after this golf course. You'll like this, Mike, if you don't know this story. God will look after the golf course. And her idea of greenkeeping was literally once or twice a week, she'd go out with the Range Rover with a hose pipe and an ATCO, and she'd do a bit of work. And it got to the point where there were 2-inch cracks in the green and stuff like that. And so it was an autocracy, but a strange autocracy. And then, of course, the Nodes family bought it. And sadly, Ron died, and his son, who's the managing director now, he's a managing director, and it's run that way. And it's not your average governance situation. But the trust have really got to understand what they own. They understand the history of it. And the trust has made the decision that they want to put it back where it was in the 1940s.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to come in then, Ed, with a different governance story. The one I heard from Ryan was Abercrombie was stood at the bar. A visitor had come in or something and just sort of, I think, had taken exception with a part of the course or maybe the condition and just said to Abercrombie, said, you know, where's the suggestion box? And the answer was, I am the suggestion box. And just, I know we're kind of close to wrapping up and big thank you for your time, but I kind of can't help but, you know, do this pod and also think full circle on what you're talking about with the Addington and of course, you know, our home club, which has benefited, I guess, from Frank's involvement for a long period of time and the renovation and restoration work at Blackwell. It does go to show the difference by having that commitment to that plan. And I guess where you see something through with that long-term plan for a period of time, the difference it'll make. And when you talk about something like the Addington that's just embarking on that work, you know, it just shows how important it is to have that front and center and kind of not deviate too much from it. Because I guess with all golf courses, you always get a sense when you work with them that you reach different points of emotion on the course. There might be a certain tree or a certain hole that people are really precious about. And it's really easy at that point, I guess, to abort the plan completely and just kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? And I guess so much of this comes down to commitment with the golf clubs to kind of follow through on those plans and kind of trust in what they're doing.
Yeah, well, with Blackwell, you know, Frank's been given the ability to do it as we do at New Zealand. Actually, they're very similar. We've been given great patience and longevity from the powers that be. Do it in bite-sized chunks so that the club can afford it, which is clearly the financial thing is important. But with a very there's a constancy to the attitude and the architectural side of things. And there's a reverence with regard to the past, but not slavishly so. And I think it's a nice cocktail. And, you know, you guys, your members there, I think both.
Yeah.
Enjoying the new 11th by any chance?
Yeah, it's fabulous, isn't it? When we're allowed to play it, that is. I mean, I could I can one hand the amount of rounds I've played in the last 3 or 4 months, but let's not dwell on that.
And that was basically, you know, we were lucky. It's like New Zealand. There was an amazing, beautiful Simpson illustration of that hole. So it was very, it was, you know, Mr. Simpson was an amazing illustrator and he gave us some plans of some of his holes. Very useful. And that 11th was one of the ones he loved to draw. And you can see why. And you have to ask yourself, how on earth did it get to the state it was in?
Yeah. You know, Frank told an interesting story. He was saying that people used to contact him and say, you know, from America and places and say, do I need to come out and see this 11th hole? Is it that good? You know, that the sketches show, is it that good? And it looked nothing like the sketches that Simpson had. I think it had about a seventh of the bunkers and it was 40 yards longer because the committees had just done it over time. And
yeah,
it's been restored now and it's a fabulous 185 yard hole. It's brilliant.
Good. Yeah. And that's fun. And it's great fun. And we're doing the same thing at New Zealand with the 10th, which, you know, the Simpsons postage stamp hole. And literally today, the boys were sanding the bunkers when I left. And we'll put some photographs up social media probably after the weekend. And I literally stood there today and I've got on my phone the 1936 picture. And OK, it's not all just about the past, but at least it now resembles it quite closely. And it's certainly not going to be just a simple flick with a wedge anymore. You'll have to think about which side. Yeah, you're going to think about if the flag's on the left, you don't go. Well, you have to think about your angles and options from there, even though it's a wedge shot.
This is the problem with you being too good a golfer, Ed. There's no such thing as a simple flick with a wedge. Only for you and Mike, I suspect.
Obviously, yesterday, the announcement of 7 Mile Beach was made, and we're all very, very excited about this this golf course and starting. And really, really excited to see what you make of it, Mike, and with Mike DeVries. And I'm sure you'll make, well, in your words, I'm sure you won't fuck it up. So, looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, it'll be great fun, and yeah, it's nice to do something with Matt. You know, I've known him for a long time. His mum was a great player, Lindy Goggin. She lost the final of the US Amateur to Julie Inkster, who was Julie Simpson then, who birdied the last two holes to beat Matt's mum, one up in the US Amateur final. So, and his uncle was a very famous Australian footballer, great player. So there's a long history of Australian sport in that family, but it's kind of fun to be doing some stuff with him.
Well, as always, Mike, we could sit here and listen to you chat forever, but we are under time constraints. So thank you guys very much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And hopefully we'll get to speak to you again. And best of luck with 7 Mile Beach.
Watch this.